Making plans can be a tricky business, what with changeable weather and misread road signs, all of which can get you into a spot of trouble as far as your well thought out intentions can go. Take the Sunday this past summer when Mark and I planned to visit Ulverston, a small town in the English Lake District that is home to the Laurel and Hardy Museum. Stan Laurel was born in Ulverston, and Mark has long been a fan of his movies. So off we went, happy to be on our way, everything fine. Except that is, until we came to one of those ubiquitous roundabouts that dot the English road system, and we mistakenly headed off in the direction of Ullswater, a completely different town from the one we were seeking. And not only did we not know we had taken a wrong turn, we didn't realize until it was too late that we were now on the Kirkstone Pass, described in much of the literature as not for the faint of heart. To add to the drama of traversing the highest mountain road in the Lake District, on this particular Sunday there was a bicycle race consisting of at least 400 wobbly riders, each of them spread along the narrow, windy lane in such a way as to cause our hearts to flutter. And despite the title of today's sermon, I don't mean with love. Yet, when we weren't praying to be saved from falling off the side of the road or vowing to never take the car out again, Mark and I were awestruck with the beauty of the landscape that surrounded us. Steep hillside outcroppings of rocks, gorgeous shades of green vegetation, baaing sheep, and clouds kissing the earth with their mist. The Lake District, located in the northwest of England, is one of the most spiritual landscapes I have ever experienced. Nowadays, we use that slippery word spiritual quite a bit, and I'm not sure we always agree about what we mean. So let me be clear. What I want to say is this. There is something in the air in that part of the world, a kind of serenity that resides above and beyond the reach of people. And during the time Mark and I were in the Lake District, it seeped inside me and settled its loveliness in my soul. I fully acknowledge this response to place may have been due to the fact that, one, the sun was shining, and two, we were in a popular place prior to the summer holidays. And that we, had we been there 3 weeks later, my experience may have been greatly altered by traffic jams and crowded souvenir shops and hordes of wild-eyed tourists. But even imagining the hills crawling with two-legged beasts toting backpacks and gallon-sized sodas doesn't take away from the reality that these fells and valleys and lakes and mountains are there to be enjoyed by all, and they remain relatively uncluttered in their natural beauty, in large part to a few very forward-thinking people, one of whom was Beatrix Potter.
As you may know, Beatrix Potter and her brother Bertram were the children of Unitarian parents who inherited wealth from their Lancashire ancestors, many of whom were involved in the cotton trade. In fact, a number of relatives on both sides of the family owned some of those early 19th century dark satanic mills that Blake wrote about and which are immortalized in the great English hymn, Jerusalem. Following in the footsteps of these prosperous people, the Potter home in London had five servants to attend to the needs of a family of four, and the taking of a three-month summer holiday in the Scottish Highlands was the norm. It was this latter experience which provided Beatrix with a deep and recurring sense source of happiness during the long months when Bertram was packed off to boarding school and she was, more or less, confined to an attic bedroom. To be sure, Beatrix had governesses, but to our ears, her solitary arrangement sounds like a scene straight out of Dickens. Yet as desperate as her existence might have been, Beatrix Potter also had a studious mind that lent itself to the natural world, and she put her time to good use. Animals of all sorts were her constant companions, many of them secreted back to her home in London from the Scottish countryside. Those who were no longer breathing were skinned or boiled, after which their skeletons were put back together like a science puzzle for the young. As the renowned biographer Margaret Lane said of Beatrix's world, "It sounds a suffocating, boring life, but if it had not been so, Beatrix's creative urge might have found less opportunity to develop. She had a thirst for imaginative exercise, which the quiet and solitude of that upper floor encouraged. She read, drew, painted, studied insects, and set for herself the formidable task of learning whole plays of Shakespeare by heart. But the strangest and most complex experiment of all was the invention of a form of code writing in which she could discreetly record her thoughts. This extraordinary document, with more than 200,000 words written in secret from the time she was 15 until she was past 30, tells us a great deal about her everyday life. But about her inner experience, her private thoughts, her feelings, there is very little. About what really went on in her head and heart in those early years, Beatrix was as quiet as the tame mouse washing its whiskers in her sleeve, or the hedgehog curled up behind the coal scuttle."
It was only years later, when writing to the children of a former governess, that Peter Rabbit was born. And it was then that Beatrix's life entered what Margaret Lane called a magical creative time. And even though the recipients of Beatrix's word picture letters took great delight in her stories, her correspondence was to lay fallow for 7 years before it occurred to Beatrix that children other than the ones to whom she was writing might enjoy her work. Thankfully, her letters had been saved, and some tied with yellow ribbon were put away in a drawer, while others were stuck between the pages of an exercise book. One can only wonder what would have been left for children the world over if Beatrix had sent her missives via email or Facebook.
Thanks to movies such as 2012's Miss Potter, Beatrix's years of publishing rejection and later successes are well known, as is her engagement to Norman Warne, the youngest member of the family responsible for eventually bringing Peter Rabbit to the world. Still, the death of Norman due to pernicious anemia, a few short months after Beatrix accepted his proposal of marriage, is the stuff of tragic romance.
But you know what, Mark? It should be noted that Beatrix's Unitarian parents strongly objected to her union with Norman due to the fact that the Warrens were tradespeople, and hence below what even Beatrix referred to as people of our station.
Perhaps what is less known than this bit of snobbery, or less remembered, is that at the time of her fiancé's demise, Beatrix was 39 and still living at home. As a respectful Victorian daughter, it was her duty to take care of her parents, even though her father was stern and her mother disapproving, implacable, and remote.
Years before Norman came into Beatrix's life, the Scottish home the Potters rented for their summer breaks was sold, and a new location for holiday making needed to be found. Rye Castle, not far from where Mark and I stayed in Ambleside, fit the bill, and when the family made their first visit, Beatrix was 16. Rye Castle stands on the shores of Lake Windermere, near the Church of St. Margaret. The vicar at the time was Hardwick Drummond Ronsley, who, in addition to being a parish priest, was also a poet and composer of hymns. Rupert Potter, Beatrix's father, was fond of collecting autographs, especially those of the Lakeland poets, and soon Ronsley was a frequent guest at the Potter's home, where he took a special interest in the shy young daughter who spends a great deal of her time painting and drawing everything from the richly decorated interiors of the castle to the many colorful fungi growing in the woods. Ronsley was the first published author Beatrix ever met, and his passionate interest influenced her greatly. In fact, this Church of England clergyman was the embodiment of many of the Unitarian sensibilities we might expect, but don't necessarily find, in Beatrix's own parents. He campaigned vigorously to prevent a rail line that would have ruined much of the unspoiled Lakeland valleys. He organized classes in metalwork and wood carving, which resulted in the establishment of a school for industrial arts that remained open until 1986. Ronsley's interest also led him to take part in the 1898 founding of Keswick High School, one of the first co-ed secondary schools in England. And when he wasn't championing education, Ronsley fought mightily against mining pollution and the construction of roads over Lakeland passes, although clearly he lost the battle for the one that Mark and I drove over.
This dedicated man of many causes also became one of the founding members of the Lake District Defense Society, along with Lord Tennyson, John Ruskin, and Robert Browning. Years later, when he became one of the founding members of the National Trust of Britain, his work for conservation would not be lost on either Beatrix or her father. In fact, Rupert Potter became one of the first lifetime members of this newly formed organization.
After Norman Warren died, Beatrix was left the sole owner of a dream the two of them had shared, that of purchasing a farm in the Lake District. As both a response to grief and perhaps as a way to keep her love for Norman alive, Beatrix proceeded to buy Hilltop, a small 20-acre holding adjacent to the town of Nearsawry. When Mark and I first visited Hilltop's well-preserved farmhouse back in 1982, it was clear that this was where Beatrix found inspiration for what became known as her little books. Pages from Tom Kitten and Benjamin Bunny were suddenly alive before my eyes. I will never forget seeing the red-handled pitchfork stuck casually in the ground, as if Mr. McGregor were still somewhere about, perhaps just off on a lunch break, soon to return to his garden of cabbages and lettuce before Peter Rabbit had his way with its bounty.
Yet while the years after Norman's death were some of the most productive, literary-wise, that Beatrix was to enjoy, the majority of her time was still spent in London caring for her demanding parents. Only summers and a few short breaks throughout the year allowed her to visit the country her spirit so craved, although Beatrix did continue to purchase more and more property. And with each farmland acquisition, her parents became even further annoyed, not because Beatrix's investments weren't monetarily sound, but because they diverted the attention of their dutiful daughter away from themselves.
8 years after the death of Norman, Beatrix Potter realized she had fallen in love with William Helas, a country solicitor who had been protecting her interests and lending support, both professionally and personally, to her activities. William was a pleasant and amiable man 5 years her junior, and he enjoyed the out-of-doors as much as she did. Yet true to their selfish nature, when William proposed marriage, Beatrix's parents objected once again. Thankfully, as a woman of 47, Beatrix finally had the courage to outwardly think and do otherwise, although there can be no doubt that internally she was always a disciplined, free-thinking, and strong-willed individual.
October 15, 2013, marked the 100-year anniversary of Beatrix and William's marriage. It was a union that lasted 30 years. During that happy time, Beatrix became a shepherdess, working to preserve the endangered native breed of Lakeland sheep known as Herdwick, and who, thanks to her care, survived today. And while she was no longer living at home and taking care of her folks, when her father died, Beatrice purchased a home near Hilltop where her mother could live.
Like all of us, Beatrix had her foibles. She could be a bit crusty, and not all change was welcomed into her life. According to Linda Lear, one of Beatrix's other well-known biographers, at the end of World War II, tourism returned to the Lake District with a vengeance, and electricity was now widely available. Yet Beatrix was fond of neither, rebuffing fans who sought her attention and permitting electricity only in her barns and not in the house.
Maybe the cows will like it, Beatrix once suggested to her astonished farm tenant.
As for herself, Beatrix wrote by candlelight until William arrived home in the evening, and only then did she light the gas lamps. There were no exceptions, and housekeepers who complained did not remain for long. But as Mrs. Lear also writes, Beatrix Potter brought nature back into the English imagination with her books and illustrations. She wrote most of them at a time when nature was viewed as something of little value, when the plunder of nature was more popular than its preservation.
By contrast, these days, Hardwick Rounsey is little known or celebrated. Yet when he died in 1920, his obituary notice in the Times stated, "It is no exaggeration to say, and it is much to say of anyone, that England would be a much duller and less healthy and happy country if Rounsley had not lived and worked." Rounsley was a gentleman intent on seeing that the incredible landscape of the Lake District, that little bit of heaven on earth, should not become enclosed and private and off limits to the public.
Beatrix, on the other hand, purchased her many acres to prevent what she despairingly called offcomers from transforming working farms into holiday homes. And even though Beatrix's motives may sound slightly different from Rounsley's, it is clear that in seeking to save a traditional way of life, she was carrying on the legacy of one of the first people who believed in her and in her capabilities.
As a child held captive in the attic, and later as a young and not so young woman seldom allowed to travel without a chaperone, Beatrix fought tirelessly, if somewhat silently, against imprisonment and despair, encouraging her imagination to embrace and take seriously the countryside and its many forms of life.
And this love was realized not only in the rabbits Beatrix made popular when she was a writer, but in a breed of sheep. And it was there for me to breathe in the landscape that had nurtured and sustained her soul. And perhaps this is the way it always is. For what touches us most profoundly is seldom linear in its expression. We move forward and double back between the touchstones of time. For what we care about most deeply resides within us like a circular golden engagement ring, melding our hearts to the world, feeding our strengths, and giving power to our essential selves.
All outward forms of religion are almost useless and are the cause of endless strife. Believe there is a great power silently working things for good. Behave yourself and never mind the rest. In Beatrix's life, there were many people and causes, and yes, even religions, that vied for her attention and endorsement and commitment. But as you can hear from the words that I just quoted, she remained throughout her life a straightforward, no-nonsense woman, writing her little stories and painting her farmland scenes until eyesight failed and other duties took priority.
The face of love wears many expressions. Some are carved on people, some written on the landscape. Still, it takes little effort and commitment, and sometimes struggle, to bring love into being. Earlier, the choir sang a gorgeous selection, Esto les digo, based upon a New Testament text taken from the Gospel of Matthew. The song's lyrics give us, if not the exact words of Jesus, then at least what we have come to understand as a sentiment worthy of this great Hebrew teacher and the values for which he stood.
Where two or three are gathered in my name, there will I be also.
There is another memorable line many of us have read that we may not realize also points us towards the sacred. But this time it comes to us from Jemima Puddle Duck, that attractive large white bird with a blue cloth bonnet, and it states simply enough,
"She set off on a fine spring afternoon along the cart road that leads over the hill."
It was here, at the edge of Jemima's wood, that Beatrix's ashes were scattered when she died of pneumonia and heart disease at the age of 77.
Upon her death, Beatrix left nearly 4,000 acres, 16 farms, a number of cottages and herds of cattle, and Herdwick sheep to the National Trust. William Helis continued his stewardship of his wife's remaining land until he died 2 years later, at which point Beatrix's Potter's literary rights were turned over to Warren Publishing, and the remainder of her Lake District legacy was left to the National Trust.
When Mark and I spent our all-too-short time this last June walking over fields and valleys, preserved for our enjoyment by the magnanimous efforts and acts of others, we weren't alone, just as none of us is ever truly alone. Because there will always be a Mopsy or a Flopsy or a Cottontail or a Peter to remind us of those caring souls who have gone before us or who today walk by our side, paving the way so that we can pass over high, scary mountain passes.
Those many faces of love ready to save the beauty of the earth.
Leading me to believe that with the help of a Tabitha Twitchett or a Squirrel Nutkin or even a Hardwick Ronsley or a Beatrix Potter, we are all capable of working together to find our way safely back home to the transcendent.